Yeah. Maybe I'll start with this little disclaimer or reader's caution. Not always, but from time to time, I am approached by devotees that have been practicing Krishna consciousness for some years, and they say, Maharaj, in public audiences, there's always new people, and it's part of the responsibility of the speaker to speak in a relatable way for the audience. And so, in many cases, classes are introductory, and then introductory, and introductory, and introductory, and an introductory. So, sometime, can you speak something that's not introductory? We would appreciate that. And so, this is one of those. Because I know there's some participants in the audience that are more than reasonably new. They're quite new. And so I'll make an attempt, but not as I would normally. I'll make some attempt to explain something that's a little difficult. Try to explain it so it's a little simple. But less so than normal. And as I shared, you may remember from last year, the part one of Sri Brahma Samhita, I expressed something that Prabhupada had said about his hearing Bhakti Siddhanta. When the devotees had discovered this Brahma Samhita, they wanted to publish it, BBT publication. Prabhupada approved and said, but don't edit anything, because his language is a little hard to approach. But if you edit to make it more approachable, you may very well lose what Bhakti Siddhanta intended to convey. So don't edit anything. And so when you try to read Brahma Samhita, it's a little difficult, because his language is difficult. What to speak of, the concepts are very elevated. So, Prabhupada said, as far as articles of Bhakti Siddhanta in Back to Godhead magazine, just print one or two pages, because otherwise their brains will be puzzled. Prabhupada said, when I was hearing Bhakti Siddhanta speak, hearing my Guru Maharaj speak in his native tongue and my native tongue in Bengali, I would sit and I would listen and my brain was puzzled. But I had faith, so I'm encouraging those of you that are a little new to listen to Prabhupada's words. I had faith that simply by hearing, my consciousness would become purified. So there, again, for persons that are new, or on the newer side of things, some of this may be a little challenging to fully comprehend. Don't worry. Prabhupada said his brain was puzzled. So if your brain is a little puzzled, you're in good company. And the solution that Prabhupada gave when something that's, you know the source is correct, but you don't fully understand it, he said, read it again, or in this case, perhaps, listen again. And then, again, if you don't understand, listen again, and read it again, listen. And gradually, because purification is taking place, the capacity to understand it, it's not an intellectual, this is not meant to be an intellectual seminar. It's a spiritual seminar. I spoke on this Brahma Samhita, the prayers part in China, to with a translator during their national holiday in Beijing, and many of them were also very new. And the concepts were, to them, very new. But my experience was, and some of them shared with me, you know, at the end of the whole, it was an experience of consciousness just going, which isn't due to some intellectual gymnastic, it's due to the sound vibration elevating consciousness. So that's what I'm hoping for. And again, if the concepts seem a little high, that's okay. Listen to it again and read it again and like that. And have confidence that it will be purified. That was my experience, just sharing at the beginning of this, the very first literature, Krishna conscious literature that I read was a Back to Godhead magazine when I was in college. A fellow student, Warren Weinstein, who became Bhurijan Prabhu, gave me Back to Godhead magazine. I didn't know what it was. I knew who Bhurijan was. I didn't know what Krishna consciousness was. I just knew him. And he gave me a magazine. So I just was carrying this magazine around with me, along with my clipboard and my stack of books and the Back to Godhead magazine. And in the course of time, somebody saw the magazine and they went, "You're into that?" And I said, "What's that?" They said, "Well, that's, you know, I don't know why you're into that." I said, I don't even know what that is. So that gave me enough curiosity to read the magazine. And the main article in the magazine was an article by Bhaktisiddhanta. And the title of the article was "The Bhagavat, Its Ontology and Morphology." I got out my dictionary, what's Bhagavat, what's ontology, and I knew what the word what meant. And then I read the article with my dictionary by my side and, you know, writing things in the margin and looking up words and trying to piece it all together. I've mentioned this in other presentations. Because I was a pre-med student, I was used to technical things that initially the language is a little forbidding, and you know, so that didn't bother me. It didn't impress me, it didn't worry me, it just was part of being a student, learning something. But I found, well, two things. Time just flew. 3 hours passed, I wasn't looking at my watch. I was just absorbed. And that was nice. And then the other, more important thing is I felt my consciousness was in another place altogether. It was an experience. And it was a nice experience. I felt like, wow, this place of consciousness can be accessed through a personality like Bhaktisiddhanta. And it wasn't because it was, you know, challenging language. It was Bhaktisiddhanta's association. So before I even became a devotee, I had respect for Bhaktisiddhanta, a very special place for him in my appreciation book. And then, as I was becoming a devotee, this is 1969, 1970 period. Prabhupada had already, he started the Hare Krishna movement formally in 1966. That was, you know, the incorporation of ISKCON. And by 67, in New York City, he had the devotees rent time in a recording studio and recorded the Brahma Samhita prayers. And you know, just close your eyes for a moment and imagine you're a world acharya. And your mission is to give Western people the opportunity to connect with Krishna. They don't know anything about Krishna. So what are you going to do, world acharya? And what Prabhupada did, of course, was chanting Hare Krishna and his Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. But the very first thing that he recorded, at least the first thing that I heard, was the Brahma Samhita prayers. And I didn't know what it meant. I just was very much appreciating the sound, you know, the devotion of Prabhupada's voice. It was so moving. I probably, you know, because every time, and in temples, every time we sat down for prasadam, we heard the Brahma Samhita prayers, Prabhupada singing, or working in the kitchen. New devotees do lots of work in the kitchen. So, I grew up with Bhakti, appreciating Bhaktisiddhanta and the Brahma Samhita prayers, and I always wanted to learn the meaning of the prayers. And but something that really inspired me to do the kind of depth study that I've been doing is this letter, which Prabhupada wrote in 1967 to Pradyumna. Pradyumna was a Sanskrit scholar. I think he got his degree in Sanskrit from Columbia University, but I'm not completely sure. And you know, as a scholar, he liked to read books. So he found a book by Bhaktisiddhanta entitled Brahma Samhita, or his commentary on Brahma Samhita. And he wrote a letter to Prabhupada asking, as a disciple should, is it okay to read this book? And Prabhupada wrote his reply. Hopefully that screen will move. There we go. Brahma Samhita contains the highest of all spiritual knowledge. It is the gist of Srimad Bhagavatam, where everything about Krishna is perfectly described. Brahma Samhita, one who reads Brahma Samhita very carefully and scrutinizingly can understand everything of Krishna without any fault. I recommend, therefore, that all my students read Brahma Samhita very carefully, especially because it was translated personally by my spiritual master, Srimad Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj. So I'm going to need a sound item played. There's nobody back there. Ah. So, when Prabhupada recorded the Brahma Samhita, at the very end, he read some of Bhaktisiddhanta's purport. And then he spoke the following message, which our sound man is going to play right now. Well, if he doesn't play it, I can play it through the microphone. Should I play it through the microphone? I'll play it through the microphone.
The audience hearers of this record are requested to study and try to enter into the spirit of this hymn with great care and attention as a regular daily function.
So that was 1967. At the end of this recording of the Brahma Samhita prayers, Prabhupada is instructing us, his fledgling Western disciples at the time, and us as presently, that one should not just chant these Govinda prayers, but why one, as a regular daily function, one should try to enter into the spirit of this hymn. that was a sadhana or a practice that our founder Chari was passing on to his Western audience. So when I read this letter, I decided that's it. I mean, there's so many instructions that Prabhupada gave. How can you fulfill all of them? You need like 50 lifetimes at least to fulfill them all. But put the pieces together, and I was very attracted. So I spent oceans of time absorbing myself in trying to piece together its messages and how this fits together with that, with the other thing. And it's wonderful literature. Here's Krishnadas Kaviraj's description from the time when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was traveling in South India, and in the course of his travels, by providential arrangement, he visited the Adi Keshava temple where they had a copy, in fact the only known copy of Sri Brahma Samhita. And when he heard it, he began dancing, just like ecstatically expressing joy to hear the message of Sri Brahma Samhita, because it was the scriptural basis of everything that he had been teaching, in one sense. So he had a copy made, and he kept it with him, along with Krishna Karnamrita, these two books. And when before he returned back to his base in Puri, he visited Ramananda Roy and gave copies to Ramananda Roy, saying, all the truths that you spoke about on the message of Krishna, the science of Krishna, is now confirmed in these two literatures. And those of you familiar with that discussion with Ramananda Roy, it's a very elevated subject, expressed in an essence form in 62 verses here. And this is what Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami writes about the book that Lord Chaitanya found. There is no scripture equal to the Brahma Samhita as far as the final spiritual conclusion is concerned. Indeed, that scripture is the supreme revelation of the glories of Lord Govinda, for it reveals the topmost knowledge about him. Since all conclusions are briefly presented in the Brahma Samhita, it is essential among all the Vaishnava scriptures. So we're spending some time going through this essential among all Vaishnava scriptures text. And I find it very wonderful, and I hope you will also. So after Lord Chaitanya circulated copies amongst the devotees in Puri, the next generation, amongst the six Goswamis, the most scholarly of them all, Jiva Goswami, he wrote a commentary in Sanskrit. And it's been translated into English by Bhandu Swami, his commentary. But several generations later, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he took that Sanskrit commentary and made a Bengali rendering. And then the Bengali was then translated into English by Bhaktisiddhanta. In other words, disciplic succession. This nice little literature. It's not fanciful or imaginative. It's the original preceptor, Lord Brahma, giving the topmost knowledge about the spiritual world and the personality of Godhead who resides there, and his activities and his form, and in a little book. Reference to the mantras within Brahma Samhita, the prayers that we're going to be studying, is specific mention is made in relation to this Gajendra Moksha Lila. So Gajendra, according to 8th canto Srimad Bhagavatam. In his previous life, Gajendra was a king, and he was a very highly spiritually elevated king, so much so that when his son was of age to take responsibility of the kingdom, he turned the kingdom over to his son. He went to the remote places in the mountains and the forest and dedicated himself the remainder of his life to achieve spiritual perfection by meditation upon the personality of Godhead and reciting wonderful prayers to him. So one time, Agastya Muni, I think it was, came, just as also happened to be traveling the same mountain, and saw the hermitage of the king, and he went there, and when he entered the hermitage, there was no greeting. Well, the king was in meditation, absorbed, deep in meditation. And so the Muni became very angry. What kind of hospitality? You're the king and you don't even know how to receive a guest? What's happening here? Oh. It doesn't show anything on this. Technology hiccup. Okay. I have it on my screen. I'll just pretend that you'll work on it. Okay. So, the Muni cursed the king. Your behavior is like that of a dull animal. I curse you. You become an elephant. A dull animal. And the sage left. And unfortunately, King Indradumna doesn't say how quickly it happened, but he became an elephant. But he wasn't just an ordinary elephant. He was the king of elephants. Because he had that spirit, kingly spirit. And many, many other elephants were following around this king of the elephants. And one time, the elephants were bathing in a lake. You see the lake in the image here. And while they were bathing, the alligator that lived in the lake was disturbed, saying, "You know, this is my lake. What are you doing here?" So he came and chomped on the leg of Gajendra. And Gajendra started shaking his leg to get free from the alligator. And did work. The alligator was tenacious and he held on in the big battle for a long time. And both of them were very powerful, but neither of them was winning until after a long, long, long time. It says 100 years. That's a long fight. Gajendra became weak, and as he was becoming weak, he had this realization that I'm finished. And so, within his heart, Paramatma, the Supreme Soul, brought to his mind's attention the prayers that he recited in his previous life. And so with deep sincerity, he was calling these prayers, even in the body of an elephant. And the Supreme Lord heard his sincere calling. So he came, as you see in the picture. Lord Vishnu riding on the back of Garuda, and we'll go back to this. Well, they both show. And Gajendra wanted to express something, you know, besides the alligator chomping on his leg. So he, with his trunk, he picked up a lotus from the lake and held the lotus up as an offering to Lord Vishnu. And Lord Vishnu then released his Sudarshan Chakra. You can see in that picture there, the chomping part of the alligator was separated from the rest of the other parts of his body. He severed his head with the Sudarshan Chakra. And when that took place, the alligator had, from the body of the alligator came a Gandharva. And the Gandharva, with folded palms, praise the Supreme Lord, because you released me from a curse that I had received as a Gandharva, and now I can go back to be Gandharva Loka and resume my activities. Gajendra, on the other hand, had his mind completely fixed in devotion upon the personality of Godhead, and so he was not only liberated from the crocodile's clutches, but he went back to Godhead. It doesn't give how much time it took for him to go back to Godhead, but he went back to Godhead. And the text from Srimad Bhagavatam that describes this, you see here. Shukadeva Goswami was explaining. Thereafter, the king of elephants, Gajendra, even while in the grips of the crocodile's jaws, fixed his mind in his heart with perfect intelligence and chanted a mantra which he had learned in his previous birth as Indradumna and which he remembered by the grace of Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada's purport: Gajendra was formerly King Indradumna, and somehow or other in his next life he became king of the elephants. When Gajendra was in danger, and although he was in the body other than that of a human being, he remembered the stotra he chanted in his previous life. That's why we're learning some stotras, just in case. Yatate chatata bhuya samsidhau kurunandana. To enable one to achieve perfection, Krishna gives one the chance to remember him again. And continuing in the purport, Prabhupada writes, it is imperative, therefore, that all devotees in Krishna consciousness, that's us, at least we're trying, practice chanting some mantra. Certainly one should chant the Hare Krishna mantra, which is the Maha mantra, or great mantra. And also one should practice chanting Chintamani Prakara Sadvaso, or the Nishinga Stotra. Ito Nishinga Parato Nishingo Yato Yato Yamin Tato Nishinga. And for those of you who are new, that those words in the purple letters, that's one of the prayers. In fact, it's the first of the Govinda prayers. So Prabhupada is advocating, my dear devotees, in addition to the Maha Mantra chanting, one should, those who are serious in Krishna consciousness, should learn these prayers and chant them daily. In fact, Prabhupada writes, every devotee should practice in order to chant some mantra perfectly, so that even though he may be imperfect in spiritual consciousness, that's us, in this life, in his next life, he will not forget Krishna consciousness, even if he becomes an animal. And then, of course, the devotee should try to perfect his Krishna consciousness in this life. For simply by understanding Krishna and his instructions after giving up this body, one can return home back to Godhead. So that's why we're, at least I engage myself in not just memorizing the prayers. They're nice prayers to memorize, but it's nice to know the meaning. And when you know the meaning and you recite something that you know the meaning, and as Prabhupada said, you enter into the spirit of this hymn, it's powerful. So that's what we're doing. That's the program for this seminar weekend. So let us start with the invocation verse, the first verse of Brahma Samhita, we'll chant together.
Ishvara Parama Krishna Sachit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarvakarana Karanam.
No, not yet. And the translation. Krishna, who is known as Govinda, is the Supreme Godhead. He has an eternal, blissful, spiritual body. He is the origin of all. He has no other origin, and he is the prime cause of all causes. And I left my notebook, but I can do it without my notebook. According to Jiva Goswami's commentary, this verse is known as the Paribhasha Sutra of the whole text. What does that mean? Sutra, most of you, unless you're really new, sutra you know. Sutra, it means a very compact, like a snowball, very compact message that has volumes of meaning in that little compact message. A terse, compact statement in Sanskrit is a sutra, and volumes of meaning are within that sutra. So this is the Paribhasha Sutra, and what that means, according to Jiva Goswami, it's one verse. There's some rules of what's a Paribhasha Sutra. It's one verse that generally comes at the very beginning of a larger text, and that one verse establishes the meaning and the purpose of the entire text. In fact, it acts like an emperor who rules many kings. So, just as an emperor rules many kings, so similarly, in a larger work, there may be many statements or truths or facts that may seem unrelated, but they're related to this one verse, the Paribhasha Sutra. In fact, they serve to elucidate or illuminate or further expand the meaning of this one verse. Here's the Sanskrit terms translated. Pari means around, like there's the term parikshana. When you look around, you look around the room. Pari means around, and bhasha means language or speech. So pari bhasha means to fully speak or to explain or define. And sutra is a little compact statement. Jiva Goswami, in his Sanskrit commentary, says that this verse is such a text for Brahma Samhita. And there's 62 verses in Brahma Samhita. This one rules all the other verses. The other verses are serving the one verse. They're further explaining or illuminations on this one verse. And then he goes further in his commentary and says, this one chapter is the Paribhasha chapter of the other 99 chapters. Now the other 99 chapters are lost. I don't know how he knows that there's 99 other ones, but that's what he says. And this one verse rules this book, and the book rules the other 99 chapters. So it's a very important verse. In his Krishna Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami is commenting on the Srimad Bhagavatam, and he indicates the same term, Paribhasha Sutra of Srimad Bhagavatam, is 1.3.28, which reads, Eti Changsa Kalapung Sa, Krishna's Tu Bhagavan Swayam. Many of you know the verse. So in that verse it's saying, very simply, Krishna is the source of everything. Because this chapter 3 is about incarnations. That was one of the questions by the sages to Sutta Goswami. So he starts a little list of forms of the Lord as they appear in this world. Buddha is one of those forms of the Lord that appears in this world, listed in Srimad Bhagavatam, and many others. And after listing, not a comprehensive list, but some number of incarnations of the Lord that appear in this world, this statement is there that Krishna is the source of all of them. In fact, Krishna is the source of everything. And that's what the Bhagavatam is teaching. Krishna is the source of everything. He's the absolute truth. There is no truth superior to him. He's the source of everything. And some of you are familiar with nectar devotion, probably a good number of you. There's a Paribhasha Sutra in nectar devotion that also many of you know the verse. Anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karmadhyo navritam anukulyena krishna rushilanam bhakti uttama, which means it's a definition of bhakti, because that's what nectar devotion is about devotion or bhakti. And this is the defining verse that rules all the other verses in the entire nectar devotion. So supposing there's something out of the 18,000 verses of Srimad Bhagavatam, this has happened. There are parts in the 11th canto that are particularly favorite targets of Shankaracharya followers, impersonalists. They like them because they can interpret them in different ways. But what Paribhasha Sutra says is no, because that whatever understanding you find over there, it must be consistent with the Paribhasha Sutra over here. And you come up with some other meaning that's not this one, it's a no understanding. The bell ring. Boo. Wrong understanding. So it's because this is an important verse, I'm beginning with this verse, that the prayers illuminate and follow this one. So the first line is Ishvara Parama Krishna. And Ishvara means controller. There's some little graphics indicating different people trying to control something. The soccer player is controlling the ball, and the control tower is controlling the airplanes, and little kids are controlling their little video games, and you know, everyone's trying to control something. So everyone that's controlling something has someone controlling them. And there's no exception except for one. And that's Krishna. He's the Parama Ishvara amongst all Ishvaras. He's the supreme, he's the controller of all controllers. And he has a name. Krishna. Ishvara Parama Krishna. Krishna is controlling everyone, but he's not controlled by anyone. That's what Parama Ishvara means. So some examples, Lord Brahma, he creates the universe. You know, somebody may create a software program, or somebody may create a Sunday feast, or somebody may create a temple, or somebody may create a skyscraper, or somebody may create something. Lord Brahma, there's nothing compared to Lord Brahma. He created a universe. But the ability to create the universe, or to create the Sunday feast, or whatever it is that you're creating, to do anything, the ability comes from the same source, Krishna. And once the universe is created, there's ruling personalities that supply the necessities within that universe, and that their powers to do so are come from Krishna. This is the demigods approaching the ocean of milk as they're appealing for Lord Vishnu to descend on earth and relieve them and Mother Earth of the overburdening influence of the demoniac kings. Lord Indra, just this last month we observed Govardhan Puja, and with this Govardhan Puja, the whole event of Indra having his pride removed by Krishna. So Indra came before Krishna and worshipped Krishna. Lord Brahma, when the stealing of the calves and the cowherd boys to test the extent of Krishna's mystic powers, he comes before Krishna and offers his prayers to Krishna. So, in summary, Ishvara, Parama Krishna, he is the supreme controller. And then, very important, second message is his vigraha, or form, is full of eternality, knowledge, and bliss. God is not formless. God is with form. And the form of God is not like our form. So, let's do this a little slowly. Most people, animals, and humans, both, and all the other species, insects and birds and fish, and identify the self with the body. Most people do that. Some people have some understanding of the soul and the body distinct from one another. That's nice. The degree to which that conception is clear is really rare. But at least, you know, the notion that there's a soul different than the body. That's nice. But then when we speak of God, the Supreme Person, how is it possible that He has a material body like we have a material body? Well, He doesn't. So if He doesn't have a material body, by inference, by definition, by negation, it comes to the notion that He has no form. By intellectual gymnastics, He has no form. Well, the Brahma Samhita wants us to know, yes, He does. He has a spiritual form. I'm looking at the clock, and it keeps moving. And I wanted to tell a nice little story that would just help appreciate, you know, how important it is to understand what is rarely understood about God having a spiritual form. I don't know if I'll be able to do it. So, it's a nice story. I'll just say it anyways. I hope you can stay a little bit late, because tomorrow is no work and no school. So, at St. Louis ISKCON, I'm looking at you got it, Crystal. We have had a regular program at Washington University, not the University of Washington, but Washington University in St. Louis. And it's been going on how many years? 8 years. So, you know, it started kind of like really slow, few people, and then anyway, over a period of time, gradually it's picked up a little momentum. So, something that I have been doing since I became a devotee, by Prabhupada visiting the university that I attended, I wanted to assist my spiritual master in doing the same thing he was doing. So I visit universities regularly. There are some students here who are from universities of similar quality for plenty of types of programs. Anyway, there's a nice program on a Friday night. That's when they have the regular program. Some 40 students came. It was really nice, nice discussion, nice interaction. The next day, we went to Krishna House, which is almost across the street from the campus. And kind of like some of the core students that are participants in that program came so we could have a little time together. And I saw one person who seemed new, and I asked her, "Were you at the program last night?" She said, "Yes." She said, "What inspired you to go to the program?" Well, I saw on the poster Bhagavad Gita and the teachings of Bhakti Yoga. And my mother read Bhagavad Gita when she was younger, and she told me about Bhagavad Gita, so I wanted to learn something about Bhagavad Gita. So great. And, you know, is your mom still practicing what's in Bhagavad Gita? She said, well, she's a Christian scientist. I said, okay. When I went to school, there was somebody that was a Christian scientist, but I didn't really get a chance to find out so much about it. Would you mind sharing what Christian scientists say? And then maybe I can say what Krishna says about different things. She said, sure. Well, you know, I'm not like a priest or like a really knowledgeable person. I'm just a member, but I can share what I know. I said, okay, good. So it started with, well, Christian scientists believe that the living entity, the individual, is a soul, and the body isn't who we are. The body is awarded by nature to help each soul gain the maximum possible consciousness that souls can have. Soul and the body are different. Fantastic. Chapter 2, Bhagavad Gita. And then, you know, what happens if you don't? And, well, you get another body, and then you get, you know, the opportunity to continue. So fantastic. Reincarnation. Transmigration of the soul. And then the next question is, what happens if you do? You know, when that highest stage, I didn't ask the question, what is that highest stage? Just when you reach that highest stage, what happens? And the explanation wasn't as clear as the earlier ones. It was, well, you're with God. So then my question was, how do you know you're with God when you're with God? What I was getting at was, is their conception of God impersonal or personal? Like, do you exist with God in the spiritual world, or do you merge and become something? So it's a personal conception, but it's not clear what we are or what God is in that position of perfected consciousness. So I said, supposing somebody gets there, you know, just how do you know where you are right now? You have a body, you have a senses, you can see in the room, and you know, our senses tell us where we are. So in the spiritual, we also have a body, but it's not a material body, it's a spiritual body. And God has a spiritual form. That's the teaching that we understand from Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. So this was kind of like refreshing, a little more clarity to what was not so clear. We'll continue with this. But it's rare to have an understanding of form that's spiritual. And Brahma Samhita wants us to know the form of God is spiritual, not like ours. You'll hear some more as we go along. So, Satchitananda Vigraha, so eternity, knowledge, and bliss. Not only the form of Krishna is like that, but all the forms in the spiritual world are like that. Everything is like, it's made of eternality, knowledge, and bliss. So that's two of the lines. Now, anadir, adir, Govinda. There are two terms that are opposites or contradictory. Adhir, and you put the A-N in front and it's not. Adhir and not Adhir. He's the original and he has no origin. He's the origin of everything else and nothing else is the origin of him. And who is that? Govinda. Now, we already heard Ishwar Parama Krishna. Now we're hearing about Govinda, and Govinda is an important nomenclature, obviously because the Govinda prayers, there's emphasis on Govinda. Lord Brahma is a devotee of Lord Govinda. And what's the distinction between the Krishna and the Govinda? It's the same personality, except that the term Govinda is exclusively means Krishna in Vrindavan. So the three main residential places of Krishna in his pastimes are three: Vrindavan, Mathura, and Dwaraka. So when Krishna's in Dwaraka, he's known as Krishna. When Krishna's in Mathura, he's known as Krishna. When Krishna's in Vrindavan, he's known as Govinda. Or if you hear Govinda spoken of in Dwaraka, you know who it means. It's Krishna in Vrindavan. Yes? So that one, that feature of Krishna, Govinda, is a very important aspect of the teaching of Brahma Samhita. As we know from Gaudiya Vaishnavism, followers of Lord Chaitanya, the feature of Krishna in Vrindavan is the most intimate. We are devotees of Krishna in that feature, in that mood, and so it's Govinda. Ishvara Parama Krishna Sachit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda. So there is a nice B.G. Sharma painting of Krishna in his abode where there's many cows. So back to this girl that the Christian scientist at Washington University, I said, you know, when you reach that stage of maximum consciousness that a soul can attain, what's it called? What's it like? When you go there, what's it like? And, you know, it was definition by negation. Well, it's not like this. Or, you know when you get there. You know, it's like, I'm not saying because I don't know. So I said, well, let's do this. Supposing someone does get there, is there a way for them to communicate or convey what it's like? And she said, well, I suppose so. I said, well, our Vedic conception is it's not just suppose so, it's through sound vibration. Just like, you know, we chant mantra, that sound vibration connects one with the spiritual world. And similarly, from the spiritual world, sound vibration can convey everything about the spiritual world. In fact, my dear devotees, that's what Brahma Samhita is. It's Lord Brahma contacting, experiencing, seeing, being with Krishna in the spiritual world, Goloka Vrindavan, and describing it to us. That's what the prayers are. So I said to her, you know what it says, what those people that send back that message, that the abode of the Supreme Lord is called Goloka. And you know what Goloka means? It means, literally, it means the Loka, or the planet of cows. She said, no. I said, yes. In fact, why no? She said, well, you can't have cows like this in the spiritual world. I said, of course you don't have cows like this in the spiritual world. You have cows like the original cows, and these are reflections of those. Like the Old Testament speaks of, man is created in the image of God. image of God means he has form. It's not a form like ours. Ours is a form like his. The cows are like those cows, but those cows aren't these cows. Those cows are different. She said, well, I don't know about that. So it's taking the difficulty is taking things within our limited experience and trying to understand that which is beyond our experience. It's inconceivable. But this is Krishna. He loves cows, and cows love him. It's Goloka, and he's Govinda, and Gopal. But it's not just cows love Krishna, it's a land of love. Everyone loves Krishna. The creepers love Krishna, and the bumblebees love Krishna, and there's different varieties of love in the land of love. The land of the most confidential, intimate love. That's the abode of the personality of Godhead. And then Sarva Karna Nakarna, the last line. The personality of Godhead, Krishna, he's the Karana, or he's the Karanam of all Karanas. He's the cause of all causes. That's what this verse is saying. Krishna is the source of all incarnations, and so forth. So now, this clock just keeps moving. It doesn't stop. So I want to do, well, I'm scheduled, I'll go ahead. You just be patient with me, please. I do a little review of the parts of Brahma Samhita that we covered last Thanksgiving, quickly. You see this brass plate here? This is called a yantra. Yantra. Yantra, the word appears in Bhagavad Gita. Yantra Rudhani Mayaya. Krishna says the living entity is situated as if on a machine made of the material energy. So yantra means machine. So this is also a yantra. Yantra is a diagram of the spiritual world. Just like, you know, the deity form is Krishna. It's not a representation of Krishna. But in bhakti, the deity is Krishna. Similarly, this yantra, it is the spiritual world. It's a depiction of the spiritual world, but it's the spiritual world. And this photograph came from Bhanu Swami. Maybe some of you can read it. I can't. It's a yantra that describes Krishna Loka. Maybe some of you have been to Mayapur. Some of you from South India and have seen yantras on altars and have some idea what this is. Okay. Here's the Nisringa altar in Mayapur. And you see down at the bottom, there's Lord Nisringadev, and then just below him there's all those Shalagram Shilas, and then to his right or to our left there's Prahlad, and just below Prahlad on that same elevation there's two brass plates. Those are the yantras. Here's a close photograph of them. This is a Nisringa yantra depicting the abode of Lord Nisringa. And this is the Goloka Yantra, or Govinda Yantra, or the abode of Krishna. This is an artist rendering of that brass plate. So it's described in verses 3 through 5 because along with mantra, Lord Brahma engaged in the process of meditating upon this, the abode of the Supreme Lord in this form. Tamal Krishnamurti calls it a mystical diagram. So here's the Roman translation of what you saw in that diagram. And if you noticed in the inner circle, there's two triangles, inverted triangle and a right side up triangle. And when those triangles intersect, in the middle part there's a six-sided figure or hexagonal figure. When you read Brahma Samhita in text 3, you'll scratch your head when you read this hexagonal mantra. That's what it is, what it looks like. And in the center, there's clean, and then there's another, one mantra on the outside in that six sides, and then there's another mantra that just showed up in that white portion. And then surrounding, well, we'll do this. This is a poster that some devotees have made. Looks like there's one of those posters back there. So at the top, as you see on the left-hand side, it's the diagram of Goloka, the inner portion of Goloka. It's just like a lotus flower. The inner portion has a whorl or corolla from which the petals grow. And that inner portion is the abode of Krishna, and the petals are described in this little Brahma Samhita as the abodes of the gopis and other associates of Krishna also. And then in that white area outside, the square or the quadrangular region, is Dwarka and Mathura, the abodes of Vasa, Dev, Pradyumna, Sankarshan, and Aniruddha. And the whole thing, all of it together, makes up Goloka, the abode of Krishna. So remember that brass plate, that's the yantra, that's the abode of Krishna, because where Krishna is where his abode is, and where his abode is where Krishna is. So it was part of the process that was followed by Lord Brahma to achieve his realization. He did mantra chanting like we do. And this is verse 24, where it says that he received a particular mantra, Gopal mantra, it's referred to as, from the goddess of learning Saraswati, the divine consort of the Supreme Lord. A little note, there's no universes yet. In fact, there's nothing yet. There's a lotus and darkness in all directions. So this isn't the goddess of learning that many people in India go to worship before they take an exam. Not that one. Because there's no exam, there's no teachers, there's no planet, there's no creation yet. So the mantra was received from the internal potency of the Supreme Lord, we could say, the original Saraswati. And she blessed him, assured him that his heart's desire would be fulfilled through this chanting of this mantra. When we hear that Lord Brahma engaged in tapa or tapasya or austerity for some long time, this was his austerity, he chanted his mantra. And some verses later, there's the mantra inscribed in the center, making that six-sided figure. After some while, some 1,000 celestial years of mantra chanting, he received a second. This is called his initiation. He was initiated by Krishna. The flute, sound of Krishna, depicted in this painting, the sound of the flute of Krishna entered his ear, and that was his initiation, and from his mouth came another mantra, Kama Gayatri mantra. And that's mentioned in verse 28. Enlightened by the recollection of that Gayatri, embodying the three Vedas, Brahma became acquainted with the expanse of the ocean of truth. Then he worshipped Krishna, the essence of all the Vedas, with this hymn. So this hymn is the prayers. That's preparing us for the first of the prayers. In the purport, Bhaktisiddhanta writes, Brahma thought thus within himself, by the recollection of Kama Gayatri, it seems to me that I am the eternal maidservant of Krishna. So this is the first thing. with mantra chanting, there's two major areas of realization. One is who you are, and the other is who Krishna is. So who you are, in this case, is with not just I'm spirit soul, but what's one's eternal rasa, eternal mellow of love in relationship with the Supreme Lord. That's within the mantra, and it's attainable simply through chanting a mantra. And the second is to realize Krishna. In fact, here it's saying he became well acquainted with the ocean of truth. And truth with a capital T. You know, everything that exists comes from Krishna, and to understand the relationship of all things as they come from Krishna in their fullness is possible if one does mantra chanting properly. So that was the process of Brahma's realization, and I'd like to describe the first verse. And this is going to require sound. Or can I just do it with my microphone here? You can play it? Go ahead, give it a try. Okay. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, the first progenitor, who is tending the cows, yielding all desire, in abodes built with spiritual gems, surrounded by millions of purpose trees, and always served with great reverence and affection by hundreds and thousands of goddesses of fortune, gopis. This text 29 is the first of the Govinda prayers. They run through verse 56, so that's how far we'll get into Brahma Samhita. And 29, this one, 30 and 31, according to Bhakti Siddhanta, they form a little group. And specifically, the first one is describing the abode of Krishna, Brahma's realization of what is Krishna's abode like. Then the next one is, what is Krishna's form like? And the third one is, what are Krishna's pastimes like? So, Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. The unprecedented glory of Govinda is the subject matter of these first three verses. And again, because of time, it's whose son is this boy that's throwing his hat in the air? In verse 39, another of many of the very nice verses of Brahma Samhita, there's a description of the hierarchy of realms, starting from this one, where we are, Devidam. Above that is Maheshdam. Above that is Vaikuntha, or Haridam. and above that is Goloka. Goloka is in the topmost position. So the opulences of Vrindavan are very special. However, one who is more familiar with Vaikuntha, where opulences are unlimitedly exhibited, persons are particularly attracted to and appreciative of the opulence, in awe and veneration, the splendor and the opulence of Vaikuntha. So, to illustrate this, it's very nice pastime in Chaitanya Charitamrita. The life of Lord Chaitanya includes description of Rath Yatra and how the devotees of Lord Chaitanya would observe Rath Yatra. So there's one section after the Rath Yatra procession goes from the temple, the main Jagannath temple, onto the Rath Yatra cart in a grand arrangement of these huge deities. All the detail is described. They're placed in their seat on their throne on the Rath Yatra cart and taken by ropes, pulled to the Gundicha temple, and there they stay in Gundicha, which represents Vrindavan. They're leaving the place of the opulence of their temple and going to the simplicity by the shore in Vrindavan. And they stay there for 8 days. What's the number of days? 8 days? 9 days? Some number of days. And then there's a return procession back to the temple. In between each of those days, there's a big festival. And one of those big festivals is described in Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's called Hera Panchami. And Hera Panchami is a day when the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, she's becoming impatient. Jagannath hasn't come back yet. And she gets in a haughty mood. They dress Lakshmi in the most opulent of dresses and place her in a jeweled palanquin, and her servitors are similarly dressed in very opulent attire with opulent sticks and horns and drums and banging and ceremony and marching down to the Gundicha temple, where she's not going to have Jagannath stay there any longer. He's coming back home to his temple. And so this is a ceremony, a festival. And they take their sticks and they start beating the servitors of Jagannath. I hope nobody gets hurt. And insisting, Jagannath must come back now. The goddess of fortune is demanding. So commitments are made. Yes, he'll come back. He'll come back. And during the course of that festival, the associates of Lord Chaitanya were observing and participating. And just before the procession passed them, Srupa Damodar was describing the glories of Vrindavan. He's very much appreciating Govinda, Krishna in Vrindavan. And when this procession came by, Srivas Pandit started teasing Srupa Damodar, saying, the residents of Vrindavan, they don't know anything about opulence. They gather some flowers from some trees and some leaves, and they make garlands and they make offerings of garlands, and they live in little huts. But look at this, the goddess of fortune is riding in a palanquin made of jewels. And Lord Chaitanya, hearing Srivas going on like this, said, that was a trick. That's what it is. Srivas, you sound like Narada Muni. Because he was, Narada Muni is a Vaikuntha Vasi. He's an appreciator of the opulences of Vaikuntha. And then, I don't have the verses, but a whole number of verses are spoken by Srup Damodar. Lord Chaitanya turns to Srup Damodar and says, Srup Damodar, can you describe a little bit to Srivas what are the opulences of Vrindavan? And it starts with something like, the opulences of Vrindavan are like an ocean. And whatever the opulences are in Vaikuntha and in Dwarka, they're not even a drop of that ocean. And then he goes on with like 20 verses describing the opulent position. And it's very, very wonderful. This is one of those verses where he's describing, you're impressed that the goddess of fortune is riding in a palanquin of jewels, but the damsels of Braja, they use jewels on their shoes, and they wear jewels around their anklets. Sometimes they even just use the big jewels to hold open their doors as doorstops, because they want to see Krishna when he comes back from herding the cows. It's an amazing description of this opulence. And this clock doesn't stop, it just keeps moving. Anyway, he speaks so happily about the opulence of Vrindavan. He defeats Srivas, and Srivas becomes very happy to be defeated because he likes Krishna too. Chintamani prakara stadasu kalpa briksha. Bhaktisiddhanta writes, just as Maya builds the mundane universe with the five material elements, so the spiritual chit potency has built the spiritual world of transcendental gems. So, I don't know, whatever the materials of this building are made of. You know, buildings, you know, like wood frame buildings, and you know, the standard one in India is steel reinforced concrete. And you watch big buildings go up in New York, because there are construction going on all over around the place. You know, big steel girders and, you know, snap on walls and cladding and. Anyway, in Vrindavan, the buildings are made of jewels. The earth is made of jewels. Everything is made of Chintamani. That's what things are made of. Another beautiful painting of Goloka Vrindavan. We know a little bit from Lord Chaitanya's pastimes of Sanatana Goswami having a Sparshamani. Sparsha means touch. So he had a touchstone that would change things that are ordinary metal into gold. But a Chintamani is far, far more amazing than that. It's Chinta literally means thought. So it's a thought gem. You think of something, it produces that something. Not just metal to gold. Whatever it is you want, just think of that something, and in that spiritual realm it manifests. In Chintamani, the gosha, or the cow sheds, are made of jewels. In fact, that's one of the verses that I didn't bring with me this evening. Anyway, then there's kalpa vriksha trees. So the Vedas are sometimes described like that. It's a desire tree. The Vedas can fulfill all desire. The purpose tree yields only the fruits of piety, wealth, fulfillment of desire, and liberation. You know, dharma, artha, kama, moksha. But the purpose trees in the abode of Krishna bestow innumerable fruits in the shape of checkered divine love. That's Bhaktisiddhanta's language of saying the trees give love of God of all varieties. So here we have trees, but probably apple trees are really popular in Washington. But you know, an apple tree produces only apples, and only during apple season. Or in India, you know, very favorite fruit is mango, but it only produces one type of fruit and only in season. But the trees in Vrindavan, or these desire trees, they supplied any amount of fruit and any variety at any time. And not only supply fruits of any time or flowers of any type, but they supply anything that you want. That's what a desire tree does. In fact, just to cut to the chase, in Vrindavan, just about everything can supply just about anything. So one might wonder, you know, why don't people live in big palatial buildings and drive around big, you know, bullock carts or maybe a Rolls Royce or something? Because they don't have those kinds of desires. They have only the desire of love for Krishna. And the trees and the Chintamani and the Surabhi cows, we're going to hear just now about the cows, they don't just supply milk, they supply anything. But what do the people in Vrindavan want? They want to serve Krishna. That's all, and anything that's needed for service to Krishna is supplied abundantly. Krishna's planet is a planet where there's abundant moo cows. So many, you can't count them all. In the churning of the milk ocean, this painting is illustrating that the Kamadhenu was produced. But a cow, normally, even a Kamadhenu produces milk when you milk the cow. Bhaktisiddhanta's language is not just milk when you milk the cow, but it supplies oceans of milk in the shape of love showering transcendental bliss that does away with the hunger and thirst of all pure devotees. In other words, they bestow love of God. Some of you may be familiar with Janmadagni, the father of Parashuram. He had one Kamadhenu. And this painting is illustrating the king, Kartavirya Arjuna, who had lots of pride and was really powerful and had lots of soldiers. He went one time to visit the hermitage of Janmadagni with all of his soldiers and followers. And he made the request of Janmadagni, can you prepare a meal out here in the forest for my many, 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 many followers and our horses and our army? We're hungry. So Janmadagni said, no problem, you can take your bath in the nearby river, and when you come back, your feast will be here. So the feast was provided by his Kamadhenu, because she's a wish-fulfilling cow. She can supply anything. And that's just one cow, one Kamadhenu. In the Goloka Vrindavan, all the cows are Surabhi cows. Inconceivable. I hope you get that picture very clear. The opulences and the beauty and the splendor of Vrindavan is just beyond conception. And the cows, they love Krishna, and Krishna loves the cows. And all of the other residents love Krishna, and Krishna loves them. It's just the nature of Goloka Vrindavan, the land of love, transcendental love. And the last line is, Lakshmi Sahasra Shata Sambrama Sevyamanam. In Goloka, there's unlimited numbers. Sahasra Shata. You can't count them all. Goddesses of Fortune. It's a nice illustration of in the Goddess of Fortune in Vaikuntha. There's eight different features of her. And in Dwarka, there's 16,108 features of the Goddesses of Fortune whom Krishna married and made palaces for each one and expanded himself within each palace simultaneously. But in Vrindavan, in Goloka, the inner world of the petal of the lotus, there's unlimited numbers of goddesses of fortune. That's what's being said in this verse. This is the nature of Krishna's abode. Govindam, the refrain. Adi Purusham. Tamaham Jami. So we're done for this evening. I guess I'll see if there's any comments or questions anybody would like to bring up. Yes?
Reverence?
Why did I say what?
The verse says they're worshipping reverence.
The verse says what?
The translation, I mean. They were worshipping reverence like that and that.
Here. It's in front of me. Always serve with great reverence and affection by hundreds and thousands of Lakshmis or Gopis. So you want to know why is it speaking reverential devotion? That's your question. Let me look at the Sanskrit. Some Brahma means with great respect. Some Brahma Sevyamanam. Well, it's not Aishwarya, not that kind, but you know the intensity of the love. Could somebody close the door because the children don't understand there's a class going on? Thank you very much. Yeah. So, in Vaikuntha, for those that may not be familiar with this, in Vaikuntha, the mood of love is reverential devotion, with awe and veneration towards the splendor of the all-opulent Narayana, their jaw-dropping kind of reverence. In Goloka, that opulence is overwhelmed by the intimacy of love, and so the question is, reverential doesn't seem to be so appropriate where there's intimacy. But the least my understanding is, Sambrahma is B-H-R-A-M-A, and that word B-H-R-A-M-A means mistake or illusion or error, and Sambrahma means, you know, complete illusion. But as well, they're forgetting his position, as the Supreme Lord and accepting Him as their dear most beloved. And one who is holding someone as their dear most beloved, there's a particular kind of deep regard for that person, the dear most beloved. That kind, as opposed to the Vaikuntha kind. Anything else?
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Can you explain the difference between the Saraswati Mission and 5.4 and Srimati Radharani?
Between which and which?
Saraswati. It's mentioned that Saraswati is the divine wife of the Lord.
Okay.
How is she different from Srimati Radharani?
She's not. There's an aspect of her who is a mantra giving aspect, known as Saraswati. Radharani is unlimited, is the unlimited internal potency. And so Radharani specifically is the Ladini Shakti portion of the internal potency. Yes? So the internal potency has two other parts, the chit aspect and the sandini aspect. So the three, sat, chit, ananda, make up the internal potency. So I can't say which of those aspects of the internal potency does Saraswati conform with. Maybe the chit aspect. I don't know. But at least, you know, of the internal potency, so there's similar if not identical. It's the internal potency in any case. The primeval internal potency, before there's even material creation. That personality. You're reaching for the microphone. Go ahead. Is that it? Okay. Yes.
So Maharaj, we give an example of Paribhasha Sutra in Srimad Bhagavatam and also in Pure Devotion. So who defines this Paribhasha Sutra? Does the author, like Vyasa Maharshi, say that this
is... Of course, sure. The author, just like Rupa Goswami, he wrote Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So he determined. The subject of this book is, the message will be enshrined in this particular verse. So he determined it. Lord Brahma is the composer of the Brahma Samhita, so he determined it. Vyasadeva was the composer of Vyasadeva, so of the Srimad Bhagavatam, so he determined it. But of course, guided by or directed by the Supreme Lord. Because how can transcendental literature be composed otherwise? Right? Yes.
Maharaj, there is a question online from Bhaktin Sanya. The question is, how is it that the gopis have a different abode and Mathura, Dwaraka residents all have a different abode if it is all in Goloka?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but everyone has some residence. Like, you know, there's downtown Seattle, you can see it over that way. And we're up in Issaquah, right? Sammamish, excuse me. Sammamish. So it's like in that depiction of the of Goloka, there's that quadrangular region on the outside that's in white color, and in fact it's called Swetadweep, White Island. And they're residences of Mathura and Dwarka. So persons reside there. And Goloka, Vrindavan itself proper, is that lotus. You know, it's in one sense it's figurative, in another sense it's literal. There's lotuses, there's abodes of the gopis. That's where they reside. So the gopis have a particular mood of love in relation to Krishna, so they're very close to Krishna. And there are those that have another more a less intimate quality of love, and so their residence is further away. But they're still in Goloka. Goloka, the planet of Krishna. So I hope that answers the question. Those who are more intimate are situated more intimately close. Those that are less intimate, they're situated more remote. But they're still within Goloka. And then going downwards in the vertical direction, there's Haridam. And then there's, you know, place, there's diversity within Haridam. Ayodhya Dham is very high, and then there's the other Narayan planets in Haridam, and then there's a region below. The lower region is where Shiva Dham or Sada Shiva Loka is. Anyway, there's variegatedness within the spiritual world, including in Goloka. Anything else? Yes.
The Parivasa Sutra of the Bhagavad Gita.
It's not identified. There's what is identified is the four essential verses of Bhagavad Gita. But please consider, you know, Bhagavad Gita is part of another major work. It's literally in the middle, and it's part of, it flows from the historical part into the philosophical part and back into the historical part. So that's not, to me it's not surprising that there's not a Parivasha Sutra. Okay. So I brought with me some copies of Brahma Samhita. Once upon a time, it was out of print because the BBT in Los Angeles didn't have enough revenue to keep all the books in print, so they would keep books in print as they could, and their greatest focus was where the devotees doing the major heavy book distribution, they wanted to keep those books available for them. But here's little news from, you know, ISKCON and the BBT. This last year, in the year 2013, in North America alone, we distributed more books in 2013 than ever before, even during Prabhupada's time, when he was like pushing books. And this year we're doing 10% more than that. And what that means is books that were out of print are now in print, or at least number of them. And as we keep going, they'll have not only more books in print, like a lot of variety of books in print, and a lower price because the print runs will be larger. That means more book distribution. So it's been out of print for a long time. They finally had the revenue to print, so I brought copies with me, and I can make them available. I've been doing this, as you know, before I came here to Seattle, so I have some copies left. If you already have a copy, fine. And if you would like one, some people have asked me to do this, so I started to do this. You know, I can put a little, say, write a little something in the book so you can give you the book, or like that. You can come up afterwards if you like and make a copy available. The BBT list price is $6, and I don't require that. You can give whatever you want to give, or give nothing, and I'll give you a book, because it'd be nice to have it as we go along. I'll be making reference from time to time from direct passages, and, you know, to explain what Bhaktisiddhanta is expressing in his purports. So, thank you all very much. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Shri Brahma Samhita Ki Jai.